Hallo zusammen, liebes Online-Publikum. Ich begrüße Sie herzlich zu unserer Veranstaltung und freue mich sehr, dass wir heute in dieser sicher für einige von uns nicht einfachen Zeit die Möglichkeit haben, zusammenzukommen und zu einem spannenden Thema zu sprechen und zu arbeiten. Ich freue mich ganz besonders, unsere heutige Gastreferentin Vanessa Andreotti begrüßen zu dürfen und freue mich, dass sie heute bei uns ist, um uns ihre Arbeit vorzustellen. Willkommen, Vanessa. Während des Vortrags werden Sie bestimmt Fragen oder Anregungen bekommen. Auf Wunsch an der Referentin bitten wir Sie, sich Notizen zu machen oder Ihre Fragen im Chat einzutragen. Und wir werden dann im Anschluss noch Zeit haben für eine gemeinsame Diskussion. Und wir switchen jetzt ins Englische und ich übergebe das Wort an meine Kollegin Marie Wilke und sie wird Sie noch einmal in Englisch begrüßen und unsere Gastreferentin vorstellen. Marie?
Yeah, hello and also a warm welcome also from my side to the participants of the online talk and also of course to Vanessa Andreotti. It's a pleasure to have you and that you will present parts of your work and the work with your research collective gesturing towards decolonial futures. And thank you so much for sharing your time and your power with us. Giving a short overview about how we came together in this constellation, my name is Marie Wilke. I'm currently working in the ASTA, the political representation of students at the University of Oldenburg, and my working fields are anti-discrimination and anti-racism, and Irina Grünheit is a researcher a lecturer here in the field of migration and education. And yeah, we sat together last year talking about project ideas, and Irina and I came up with one publication of you and the concept of global justice education. And we had the idea of inviting you to Oldenburg. And yeah, now we are here in the online edition of it. And yeah, we hope that from the technical side, everything will be fine. If there are any questions around the program or technical devices, please reach out via private message to Maximilian, who's also part of the ASTA and supports us today. And he will also record the talk in audio and video. And if there are any concerns about that, please contact me. And in the end, there will be the possibility to ask questions about the content. And for that, please write them down also in the chat, or you will simply write maybe question or note in the chat, so we will have automatically a little list of speakers in the end. And we also ask you to mute yourself while listening to prevent the noises and echoes that could be there in this online form of making a talk. And yeah, so if there's anything on your mind while we are doing this online room here together, please don't hesitate to contact me or Maximilian for technical issues, and then we will hopefully find a solution. Yeah, and now I have the pleasure to introduce Vanessa in some short words. Vanessa is holding a Canada research chair in race inequalities and global change at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And her research collective, as I already mentioned, called Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures, is collaborating around different kinds of artistic, pedagogical, cartographic, and relational experiments that aim to identify and deactivate colonial habits of being and to gesture towards the possibility of decolonial futures. And also, Vanessa is working in teacher education, where she conceptualizes education as an expansion of frames or reference and of fields of signification with a view to expanding possibilities for ethical solidarities. And yeah, I'm really excited, not only as being a referent in ASTA, but also being a student of educational science, to welcome you. And yeah, thank you really much for being here and sharing your time and your power with us. And yeah, let's make it start.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. It's 8 o'clock here, so it's early in the morning. Not very early, but 8 o'clock is generally the time when I'm writing and writing and writing. I'm not used to be talking and talking and talking. So I have to start with a few acknowledgements that are important from where I come from. So the first acknowledgement is the acknowledgement that I'm speaking from an indigenous reserve called the Musqueam Reserve of the Musqueam Indigenous People. This reserve is by the side of the university, which is also located on indigenous land. And they say that it is unceded indigenous land because it was never given away. So it's the indigenous people's land, and I'm renting a house in the reserve with them because I came to Canada married to an indigenous person. But my background is also related to this. So my father comes from a German family, although I don't speak German. And there's a reason for that, but my father comes from a German family where in the 60s, his brothers were involved in the agrarian expansion in Brazil. So they were from Germany, they moved to Brazil after the First World War, and his brothers by the 60s were involved in the agrarian expansion. And that meant killing people indirectly or directly. They were killing indigenous people. And my dad, inspired by Winnetou and Western films, decided that he was going to marry an indigenous person. So he found my mom, who is an indigenous person, who wanted to marry him, but she also had her reasons for marrying him. So he wanted to be a very good person and do something about social justice. But he also wanted to help my mom whiten the future generation. So at the same time that he was very progressive, he was also very racist. And my mom also wanted to become German. She associated indigeneity, being indigenous, with being poor and with oppression, with destitution. And I had an indigenous grandmother who said, "This is not a good idea. You should be paying attention to your culture, because this other culture is going to the abyss. It's destructive. It's going to destroy the earth. It's going to destroy themselves too." So I was born in a context of struggles for social justice and these very different understandings of what being in the world should be. So this is probably why I'm doing this work, because it was very paradoxical for me to navigate this as I grew up. So because of that, I have to acknowledge also the land in the way that the indigenous people in Brazil, from the community my mom comes from, they also acknowledge the land. So they say that every time that we start a talk, we need to say that first we acknowledge the land as a living being, not property, not resource. It's a living entity. It's a metabolism that we're part of. The second acknowledgement is that for us to be here today, there has been a lot of violence. And we are kind of benefiting from this violence directly or indirectly. And we have a responsibility to stop this violence. The third acknowledgement is the acknowledgement that our ancestors wanted us to be together. So they have been planning somewhere. And then we have to thank the people who created the space for us to be together, which is Marie, and everybody that is involved in the organizing of this seminar. And the fourth acknowledgement, before we move on to the talk, is that we are all related. We are all relations. The word in Portuguese is parentes. It doesn't translate very well into English or German, but it means that we're all part of the same human and non-human family. Basically, that's what they've asked me to say every time I start a conversation. So with that said, I'm going to start talking about the topic of today, which is the enduring educational challenges of setting horizons of hope beyond modern colonial imaginaries, which is a mouthful. So the first thing I'm gonna do is to say that you can put questions in the chat, but I cannot see the questions if I'm doing the presentation. So just be mindful that I will see the questions at the end only. I can't see them right now. And when I talk about the enduring educational challenges, I'm talking from work that I do with a collective of people. I'm going to talk a little bit about that anyway, but they are artists, educators, activists who are working together to create experiments that try to interrupt this violence, but not just cognitively. We are working with the body, with also the effect, our neurobiology. So we don't think the problems are a problem of a lack of information, or a lack of strategy. We believe the problems are in our body. And the ways that we, because it's in the body, the ways that we feel and the ways we relate. What else do I have to say here? I think I'm just gonna start and just acknowledging that this is not just my work. It's the work of a group of people. So the collective is a transdisciplinary collective of researchers, artists, educators, students, and activists doing research or scholarship in artistic, pedagogical, and cartographic experiments. We work a lot with social cartographies. And they bring together concerns related to racism, colonialism, unsustainability, climate change, biodiversity loss, economic instability, mental health crisis, and the intensifications of social and ecological violence, like the violences that we can see right now in here specifically in North America in relation to racial conflict. And in that sense, I would like to acknowledge that we are living in very difficult times for everybody, but that we see these eruptions of challenges like the pandemic and like the violence. And for our group, this is just the beginning. I think we're going to see much more of that. For our group, it's very difficult to think about a return to normal. Because also normal was the problem. So we look at unprecedented global challenges that we see as not fundamentally related to information, or they're not informational problems, but symptoms of a harmful habit of being, which has relational and affective and neurobiological configurations. It's in our body. We have been saying this forever, like from the beginning, we said that we are preparing for the end of the world as we know it, because this is a way of knowing and being in the world that is harmful to ourselves and harmful to the planet. And this means surrendering the terms of our unsustainable existence based on extraction, exploitation, and overconsumption. We use a psychoanalytic pedagogy that is also somatic. It's psychoanalytic and somatic pedagogy, which is about trying to learn to exist differently, which means unlearning how to exist in the way that we have been socialized to exist. And it's inspired by postcolonial, decolonial, CRT, and indigenous studies, the literature about that, plus the work with communities in high intensity struggle in Brazil, in Peru, in Mexico, and in Canada. So we work with a network of indigenous communities that really inspire how we approach these issues and in ways that are not in the literature. We can't find what they are doing in the literature. And they don't want it to be written down. That's the other thing. So we work with a lot of translations of what they are doing into what we feel can be communicated, but they don't want it just to be anthropologically documented. So because it's a psychoanalytic approach, we talk about denials. So psychoanalysis forefronts the unconscious, focuses on the unconscious. And we in our collective, our analysis is that colonialism is not just a mode of knowing or a mode of doing things, it's a mode of being that colonizes our unconscious and our bodies. So we're talking about a modern colonial habit of being that is marked by four denials and then associated delusions. The first denial is the denial of systemic violence and complicity in harm. the fact that our comforts, securities, and enjoyments are subsidized by expropriation and exploitation somewhere else, sometimes in our own neighborhoods, in our countries, but generally it's externalized between the North and South. The denial of the limits of the planet, the fact that the planet cannot sustain exponential growth and consumption. The denial of entanglement, our insistence in seeing ourselves as separate from each other and the land, rather than entangled within a living wider metabolism that is biointelligent. So here, when we think about these three denials, the denial of violence, the denial of the limits of the planet, and the denial of entanglement, you see that the solutions that we propose to the problems that we have generally reproduce the same denial. So we want to solve the problems of the paradigm that we have created with the same paradigm that has created the problems, because we don't want to sit with the violence that this paradigm creates or that this paradigm is based on. We don't want to see the problem that this is unsustainable, and we don't want to acknowledge that we are not separate from each other. And that leads to the fourth denial, the denial of the magnitude and complexity of the problem and the difficulties we will need to face together. So generally what you see in struggles for social justice and anti-racism is that we stay at the superficial level, and our solutions are generally oversimplistic. They don't really get to the bottom of things. But this is because we also can't sit with what's at the bottom. It's too much. And this incapacity to sit with more difficulty, complexity, uncertainty without being irritated, overwhelmed, or immobilized is actually part of the problem. So here, part of the solution in the long term, but it's just a little part, is to develop capacity to sit with more things and to not be irritated and overwhelmed where we can't move forward very quickly. And this is called negative capability in the literature. So this negative capability is the capacity to sit with complexity, uncertainty, difficulty, complicity, everything that is difficult, without being irritated, overwhelmed, or immobilized. And once we have more capacity, we will be able to have difficult conversations without relationships falling apart. Because generally when we try to do that, when we try to go to the depth of the problem, people can't take it. And then relationships normally break. But unless we have a container, unless we can hold this from a very different space, we will continue to find solutions that make us feel good and look good on Facebook, or be looked at as doing good, but actually it doesn't change anything. And it's sometimes, not always, sometimes it changes something, but not, it doesn't get to the bottom of the problem. It changes symptoms, but not the root causes. So sometimes this strategies that make us feel good, look good, and be seen as doing good, they actually waste a lot of energy and a lot of resources in things that we already know they don't work. So we are worried about that in the collective, about how do we get people to think about that in a different way. So in terms of horizons of hope, which is also the title of this conversation, horizons of hope is how we imagine, what we can imagine that is desirable, right? And one of the things that we talk about in my collective, in the Gesturing Towards Colonial Futures collective, is that our imagination is also colonized. So when we imagine a better world, it is just another version of the same world. We can't imagine beyond it. So we have a research project that is looking at what indigenous people in Latin America have been doing that is unimaginable for non-indigenous people in North America and in Europe. And we have five criteria for the stories that we want to amplify. So the first criteria when we look for the stories is that they imagine the world, they set their hope, their horizon of hope, beyond modern forms of social economy. So they are not talking about capitalism, socialism, or anarchism. They are talking about something else. They set their horizon of hope beyond nation states and borders as mediators of relationships. So they are not saying we're Peruvian or Brazilian or Ecuadorian. They think that that is also an imposition, a colonial imposition. Beyond the separation between man and nature, beyond anthropocentrism, patriarchy, and separability, so that we are not separate, the idea that we're not separate from the land, which for them is not an idea, it's an existence thing. So when we say, right, talk about the concept of not being separated from the land, what they say back is, this is not a concept. Thinking in concepts is your way of thinking, not ours. This is not a concept. Beyond the single rationality and story of progress, development, and evolution, so we are looking for stories that show that stories are stories. There are many stories, and they have a very different relationship with stories. And there are many rationalities, too. And I'm not saying that all rationalities are good. They are competing, but there's the stories, and there's a reality that is beyond the stories and that is unknowable as well. Beyond social mobility as the purpose of life and beyond consumption, not only of goods, of stuff, but also of knowledge, consumption of relationships, consumptions of experience, and even consumption of critique as a mode of relating to the world. So this is kind of the basics of the word, the work of the collective. This is what we're looking at as how do we imagine beyond, or how do we set our hope beyond what is familiar to us, what we can understand, what we can imagine. So we're thinking about what is unimaginable. It's still viable, but unimaginable to us from where we stand right now. And in terms of global citizenship education and global justice education, we talk about this concept of otherwise. The otherwise here is to mark a distinction between what we're trying to move towards, we're not there yet, and what is the mainstream, both in terms of mainstream, in terms of what most people want, but also the critique of the mainstream. There's a critique of the mainstream that is still part of the mainstream. So here we are talking about education developing capacity to face and hold generative space for complexities, uncertainty, paradoxes, without irritation, without being overwhelmed, without being immobilized. Connecting dots in the bigger picture, the roots and effects of unsustainability and material and relational poverty, leading to different forms of violence, understanding how we are complicit in harm. In imagining alternatives beyond the limits of a single rationality and of a single story of progress, development, and evolution, which is the story of modernity. And here we have like a comparison table of soft global citizenship or global justice education, critical and otherwise. So the general focus of the soft approach to global justice is fostering inclusion, inclusion in and informed engagement with institutions. It's focused on belonging, increasing self-esteem, developing values for peace and equality and mutual understanding. A critical GCE, a critical global citizenship or global justice education, is more about fostering advocacy for and solidarity with historically marginalized groups. And this otherwise concept is about that, of course, the solidarity piece, but then engaging with complexities, paradoxes, uncertainties, difficulties, and wicked problems. But sometimes the solidarity work becomes very monolithic in terms of what needs to be done politically, and this is important, but it fails sometimes to see the complexities behind everything that we are doing and in relation to the bigger picture. In terms of inequalities, there's also a difference here. So soft GCE would be about helping those who are considered to be behind or excluded to catch up, jump in, and move forward with the train and the agenda of modernity. And then critical GCE is about fighting on the side of the oppressed against injustices. GCE otherwise is about tackling the root causes and alleviating the effects of historical, systemic, and ongoing violence. Here, the complexities are very interesting, that we say, for example, creating access for people to social mobility is important on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's also unsustainable. Because if we were all in the middle class, we would need about 6 or 7 planets to be able to survive. The planet cannot take everybody with the same patterns of consumption that we have in the lower middle class in the US and in Europe. This promise is a false promise. And we will have to learn to exist otherwise if we don't want to go extinct. And some people say we are already going to be, we're going to be extinct one day, but that we are actually working towards making that extinction much faster. And people like in movements like Extinction Rebellion or Deep Adaptation have been flagging the science for that, right? Then we have engagement with unsustainability, which is also different. So soft GCE would be doing one's part to mitigate the effects of climate change and consumption, supporting greener policies, fostering appreciation for nature. Critical GCE is about engaging with the limits of greening policies, critiquing greenwashing, while attending to intersectional approaches to climate justice. And then GCE otherwise is about developing capacity to face the storm. We call it the storm because it's multiple crises, one on top of the other, of the effects of unsustainability with sobriety and accountability. So we have to kind of step up, grow up, and show up differently, learn to do things very differently as this crisis starts to hit. Then we have engagement with discrimination, which is also different. In soft GCE, it's about promoting inclusion and appreciation of diversity as if this can be done in a very unproblematic way. Then we have engaging with the subtle aspects of discrimination and promoting representation, recognition, and redistribution in critical GCE. And in GCE otherwise, it's about attending to diversity within diversity. So understanding that it's not as simple as we normally tend to think. For example, thinking about indigenous people as all wanting the same thing, which is not the case. Here we have in my province, there are protests against a pipeline that will go from Alberta here to Vancouver, near Vancouver. We have a number of indigenous communities on the path of the pipeline. And many of these indigenous communities want the pipeline. Some of these indigenous communities don't want the pipeline. And there's an internal struggle. But there's a lot of environmental activists on the side of the communities that don't want the pipeline, fighting for this not to be the main economic focus of Canada, of this province. So the provinces are fighting. There's diversity within the communities. There's conflicts within the community. There's conflicts between the environmental activists and the communities that want the pipeline. So you see that it's much more complex than generally what we want to portray. So we need to go beyond the romanticization and essentialism, and we need to, as we try to do something that is unimaginable, we still need to continue to reduce harm of the system that is happening, of the people who are suffering right now, while questioning the limits of representation, recognition, and redistribution. So it's a much messier and much larger body of work than just what has been so far the let's just establish solidarity and go forward, because the solidarity is based with just part of the community, not all of the community, and people in communities want different things. So this is another, I said that we work a lot with metaphors, and this is one of them. It's a very important one, and it's coming from the indigenous communities we work with in Brazil. And it's the idea that For us to have ecological justice and economic justice, which are mushrooms, we need to have healthy mycelium, which is what is underneath. It's underneath the earth. So mycelium is the substrata, where the it's actually the plant that allows the mushrooms to grow. So mycelium are generally in a forest, for example, everywhere under the earth, and they have three functions. It's communication between the plants, distribution of nutrients, and decomposition of matter. So they help with with death. They help spread nutrients, and they help communicate. And we have the three different justices there that are under the earth and normally not talked about. So we have cognitive justice, affective justice, and relational justice as mycelium. And if we have healthy mycelium, we can have mushroom, different kinds of mushroom. But the problem is that in our society, we want to have ecological justice and economic justice without talking about cognitive, affective, and relational justice. So without addressing that, we can't have a different form, an unimaginable form of ecological and economic justice. So I think this is the last slide. What I'm gonna do is finish this with a poem, because I know that there's the issue of migration that I haven't really dealt with in the presentation that might be important for this group. So I'll show one of the poems that we have in the collective. It's a poem that I actually wrote when I was living in Finland from 2010 to 2013. And lots of very difficult things were happening there at the time, especially in my town, where there were murders, three murders that were racially motivated. And people didn't want to talk about that because there's no racism in Finland. Everybody knows that. So this idea that Finland is this great place that really welcomes everybody is in people's minds there. And what was happening too is that the Finnish people who started addressing racism and saying there's racism here, they were starting to get letters from the far right saying you can't say that about our nation, and they started to get death threats. So when I created this poem together with a group of migrant students who were with me, so I tried to incorporate my experience and their experience in the poem, we published it with a pseudonym. I didn't put my name on it when it was translated into Finnish and published in a newspaper. And we created a fake Gmail account as well. And we received a lot of death threats too. So I think the poem illustrates this issue of affective, cognitive, affective, and relational justice. How it's very difficult to do anything different if we don't address this thing. So the poem talks about inclusion that doesn't address the mycelium. So I'll just change this and then we can have a conversation. Oh, sorry, I just put here that if you want more on the global citizenship and global education, there is a page on the website, and it's this page that has more resources specifically related to that. So if you want to write it down now, because we're gonna move to the poem, and I'll see if I can find it now. I can also put it back on the chat, so that's okay. I'll leave it. So I'll find the poem now here. Share. So this is the poem that received the death threats. It's called Brutal Kindness. And it starts like this. We welcome you in our nation, our borders open only to a few. We ask for nothing in return, except that you recognize the deepest wisdom, that when in Rome, you do as the Romans do. Therefore, you must speak our language, admire our deeds, adopt our dreams, obey our laws, embrace our values, praise our intelligence, like our food, fulfill our expectations, mimic our behavior, contribute to our economy, aspire to be like us, commit to staying here, dedicate your life to our people, and be thankful for our efforts to help you. we offer you unlimited hospitality. We chose you amongst countless others. We ask for nothing in return, except that you acknowledge the ineptitude of your people and the natural exceptionality of ours. Therefore, you must know your place, do as you're told, strive for your best, work twice as hard, feel indebted, show good manners, be clean and organized, get an education, dress appropriately, smell nice, pay your duties, lay low, be happy, focus on positive things, use language that we can understand, entertain us with your culture when requested, and jump off the balcony if required. We give you access to the best welfare and education system. We expect you to show us that you truly deserve it. We ask for nothing in return, except that you appreciate the privilege of being allowed amongst us. Therefore, under no circumstance should you break our trust, complain or communicate disapproval, expose our inadequacies, reveal our contradictions, disclose our insecurities, question our principles, challenge our authority or understanding of reality, make up unreasonable accusations, attempt to restrain our speech, fuel internal dissent, intellectually or biologically inoculate unauthorized foreigners, defy our right to distinguish our heroes, remind us of what we choose to deny, speak of the past we want to forget, outperform, outsmart, outshine us, or bite the hands that feed you. We will do everything in our power for you to properly fit in. We are certain you will acknowledge our benevolence. We expect nothing in return, except that you salute our openness, altruism, and sense of justice, and sacrifice your difference for the greater collective good. Therefore, you will not mind when your confidence vanishes, your autonomy disappears, your will dissipates, your language expires, your dreams are interrupted, your body and mind placed under surveillance, your freedom restricted, your voice silenced, your conscience muted, your wings clipped, your capacity undermined, your life shaped into conformity, and your soul placed under arrest. We will give you a secure future in an incomparable country. We ask for nothing in return, except for your compliance and obedience. We have zero tolerance for the crime of ingratitude, your choice not to conform to expectations or contempt for traditions and protocols will bring upon yourself unimaginable consequences as a public reminder of the immorality of your character. Clear evidence that you have always been ungrateful, arrogant, undeserving, deceitful, sly, lazy, corrupt, and incompetent. Someone who should have never been allowed to set foot in this country in the first place. Okay, so that is it. Thank you very much again for entertaining this for such a long time. And I think now we can open up for the conversation. Marie, would you like to chair it?
Sorry, I didn't understand it correctly.
Would you like to facilitate the conversation? How would you like to do it?
Yeah, I would open up the room for or the space for discussion, and maybe we can do it in that way that maybe it's better that everyone who wants to ask a question or has a note maybe writes in the group chat, and then we can organize it quite like, yeah, that everyone has an overview about how to speak
one about the question. And what if people want to ask in German? Would that be possible for it to be translated?
Sure, I can try to translate. Yeah.
I also have a German speaker at home. I could get him out of bed.
As you like, but I can try to do it, and maybe it will work.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, who wants to start? I think it was a really impressive talk, and I will put my video on. I'm back here again.
And if you want, I can put back slides. If somebody has a question about a slide, I can go back to that. And I know you didn't record it, right? So I have, because I think there was a request for it being recorded. I have a very similar, it's not the same, but it's very similar recorded version on our channel. I can go there now and find the URL and put it there, but it's not the same. The same.
We also did a record in an analog way. Like a person of the ASTA is also with us, and he is recording it in audio and video. So
okay, so I don't have to worry.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could also start with a question.
Sure.
If anyone wants to join in, please join in. Ah, there's a question. Then maybe this one first in the chat. Are there real world examples of GCE otherwise to make the concept more graspable?
Yes, there are. But they are not written down. So I have stories. Actually, one of them is, there are some organizations in Brazil that work with bringing people from the global north to the global south that are actually doing it. There are other people doing it with people in Latin American countries, not necessarily foreigners coming through. But what they're trying to do basically is create a kind of education where discomfort and the difficulty is really part of it, right? So the main thing about these kinds of education is that you cannot shy away from discomfort. This is part of the experience. You have to become comfortable with discomfort. So one of the organizations that does it is Unicities in Brazil. And I know I will just tell one of the things they do with their people so that you have an idea of the level of challenge in this work. So they bring students from Ivy League institutions in the US. So Harvard and Berkeley and all the big name universities, they bring students from there, from all kinds of different areas. And they have a program in Brazil where they stay there for 3 months. But one of the things they do as the students arrive not knowing too much about the program. So they stay in a hotel the first day, and the second day, then the rest of the time they're going to be in a family. But the second day they go to this community, which is a very poor community. It's one of the slums. And they are placed in the middle of a football field. And the young people of the community surround them. And they surround them like this, but very suspicious of what they're doing there. So all these Americans in the middle of the football field, all the other, the community around them, and then they use spoken word, slam poetry, to tell the visitors that if they think they came there to teach them anything, to fix them, they are wrong, because it's their privilege that causes the poverty, material poverty that they see around them. But there's a lot of relational wealth in this community, and that's what they are there to learn, because with the relational wealth, they will be able to go back to the United States and change their culture so that there's no poverty there. So it's a very, and the young people who are in the middle of this football field generally feel very disoriented and very uncomfortable with this. But what happens in the rest of the week in that community is that they don't talk about it. It's not about talking. They go straight into art practices and embodied practices. So they put the young people together and they do a lot of art together, a lot of capoeira, dance, a lot of things with the body. And by the end of the week, the young people from the United States start to understand what relational wealth is in terms of relational justice and effective justice, and how that critique that they received actually works in practice. So it is that kind of very unusual and counterintuitive program that is not based on just information, but is based on involving the body and understanding the complexities of things. Did it answer your question? I don't know. Oops, now there's more questions. Let me see here. Marie, do you want to read them? And
there's a question from Sita. Have you come across the concept of triple loop learning, learning, changing basic values as you do it?
Yes, I think part of our work has moved away from values because people may say they have a value, but their body is wired to do something else. So, and that's something interesting that happens. It's a very Cartesian, well, the idea that we operate, like our thinking determines our behavior is a Cartesian notion, right? So, but we have people, for example, that have beautiful values, but when actually the time comes when you are in a crisis, you can't operate from those values. You then become very defensive and you go completely the other way. And we have the opposite too. We have people with terrible values, but when they are in crisis, actually they can operate from generosity, compassion. So when we work with Indigenous people, they say, I'm not interested in what you're saying. I'm interested in what you can do in an emergency situation. That's where your real values are going to come up. It's not what you say you espouse, right? But I think the triple loop can go there if you understand this nuance, right? The triple loop is how do we talk about the, like how do we change the disposition that we can respond for to something from a different space, from a space of sobriety, from a space of generosity, from a space of compassion, of humility, of patience and of healing. So it's a political practice that is more related to healing these things than to establishing a manifesto or a statement or something. And I think this came up, this has been coming up because of what's happening here in North America, especially in the US. So a lot of institutions right now are coming up with statements condemning the violence and racism. And this is all good. I'm not saying this is bad. The problem is that they keep asking people like me and other Black and Indigenous people to correct their statements. And when they asked us to correct the statement, they tell us that this is more about the optics of it, right? So how they want to be seen. And if that's the case, it's symbolic. It's not going to change anything. Right? It's just going to be there and it's going to not, it's just performative. They are not the difficult work of really doing the three loop thing of changing everything is number one, painful, number two, complex, number three, messy and uncomfortable. Do people want to do it? No. Like my colleagues, they're going to say no. So we, what we've been saying here is that there's the job, which is yes, put the policies and the statements there. And there's the work. The work is in the body. The work is what we need to do in, internally. And then understand that it's neurobiological, it's neurofunctional, it's neurochemical, and it is epigenetic. So it's we're bringing all this trauma with us in the body, both all everybody, like on the BIPOC people, the non-BIPOC people, like the all these distinctions that we make, we're all traumatized and we need to heal first. So there's people like Rezma Menakin in the US who works with cultural somatics, which is very similar to what we do in our project, that have been tackling that, that saying things and focusing only on the values is not going to change anything, because at the time that you are pushed against the wall, there is an emergency or a crisis, you're not going to be able to operate from what you say. You will operate from what's already in here. So there's, but this is important. I'm not saying don't do the statement. Do the statement, do the policy, and understand that this is limited. Then you have to do the work, which is much more messy and complex. Yeah, that's my response to that. Let me see if there's more.
So what do you think, there's a, like kind of respond to your elaboration? Should we finish that first and then go to the other questions? Or maybe...
Can you read the response, please? Because
Thanks a lot for your answer. I believe you that your approach is tough, but aren't there hilarious moments too if people move and change?
Yes, and humor, what we do when we work with the psychoanalysis part of it is that we use a lot of metaphor, but also a lot of absurd things, because the unconscious operates through images, right? Not logic. So we have, for example, the broccoli agreement or the Brussels sprouts accord for this kind of work. And we have a metaphor of the bus, for example, that we use to hold space that says you have a whole bus of people within you. And we have very funny pictures too to bring that forth. And we have learned that the funnier it is in the process, neurobiologically, we are disarmed, and then we can learn. Then the healing happens. So there are moments that are super difficult, super hard, and you have to really like go there. But most of it is actually quite light and funny. And some people get irritated by that too. It's not like everybody responds in the same way. And but using play, using art, using play, using music as well. We were recording yesterday with a group of young people who wanted to take one of the poems that we have and transform it into a song. So we went to a studio to record it yesterday. These are the kinds of things I think that really can move something, because the thing we are interested is in movement, not in things moving, rather than in creating something perfect, right? So pedagogically, humor, the hilarious, what's hilarious can help a great deal if used at the right time, and it is funny. And we talk a lot about shit basically too. So we say that we need to compost our shit. We need to compost our shit so that it becomes new ground, new soil for things to grow. And there's individual shit, there is collective shit, and we are kind of immobilized by shit basically, because our affective levels are so saturated right now that we can't move. So we say, for example, that we need a shit composting party to be able to do that. And that works, because we know that without joy, we can't move, basically, and establish this visceral connection, right? Because otherwise it becomes either too here, too much here, or too here, you go too much inside. There's a balance. We say that 20% is cognitive. We have to work with cognition. It's just not just, let's just move to the body. No. That we need to work with the intellect, we need to work with the affective relations that we have, we need to work with relationships, we need to work with the exchanges that we do, the economy of it, and we need to work with the land. So this is 2020. And they map onto ecological justice, economic justice, affective, cognitive, and relational.
Thank you. Jimmy also has a question, and he says, I thank you guys for organizing this amazing talk. These topics are being talked at university levels. What else can be done to be taught in schools? I think bringing awareness to an adult person will take longer than young generation.
Yeah, that's so what we have found in our work is that it depends, like an older person who is close to the edge of this is not working can shift very quickly. An older person who is really invested in the system might not change that quickly or not even be interested. But with young people too, it's like it's becoming even in primary school, or the society is so good at inculcating these desires and these promises about selfhood, about consumption. It may be also very difficult already to change people who are in primary school, for example, because they are very much, they were born in a time where narcissism is really high, where consumption is really high, and where they are treated themselves as consumers, right? Even by their parents. So coming up with these concepts to a context where the children are still, are already in that mode of being might have the same effect as working with the adults. We in the Gesturing Collective, we do have a conversation about working with people at the edge, be them young people or older people, but people who really need it will find it useful. People who are super invested in individuality, in consumerism, in social mobility, in status, in superiority, there's not much we can do at that level. Other people can do other things there. It's not our job. Our job is to work with those already at the edge. But we do have some resources for children that try to interrupt things. They're not on the website yet. They're like children's books where you kind of start to talk about this and foster that sensibility. But we're finding that the sensibility of consumption is also very well rooted already when kids are young. The thing that is really helping, I think, because we are trying these resources with our own children. My children are big, but I have two stepchildren. And we have lots of people in the collective with access to children, basically. But the affective work, the emotional work, is the work that really needs attention right now, because they're coming into a world with a lot, where a lot is happening. And we haven't prepared them for that. So this is a good time. If you're going to do work in schools, this is a great time to do work in schools because it's saturated. And if we go, instead of going with cognitive things, we go with affective things, things that help them compost shit and declutter, it may work much better than saying, okay, these are the values, this is how you do peace, or this is how you do justice. No, we have to start from where they're at in terms of seeing what's eating their heart. I think one of the resources is we have a Lego tractor excavating a heart and then a trash truck, stuffing it with stuff, stuffing that hole with stuff. And we talk about that. So what is it? What is excavating your heart? What is creating the pain that you feel? And understanding that consumption is only a compensation for that pain that doesn't really mend the heart, that doesn't bring the heart together. And then we talk about if we can't bringing one heart together is one thing, but we have to bring everybody's hearts together and become one big heart. And so trying to go in through that direction may be much easier. But in order to do that, you need to work with the teachers first so that you can, if you're going to work in the formal system, it's much more complicated. And I work, for example, in a teacher education program where there's no space. They have a year only in the curriculum, and the most of the time is spent with the compulsory things that they need to know. And most of the teachers that come through our system think that the system is already working, and they don't, they're not very, they just want to reproduce it. They don't have this impetus to change or desire to change it because it has worked for them. It's complex, basically.
Yeah, and the next question is also, yeah, going in that direction. It's from Irina, and she asks, when we think about the education of future educators, what would you say? What first steps can be taken to establish the vision of which you speak in the education of the university or at the university?
So I'm working with different, at the university, I'm working with different groups that have self-organized, and as well as a group of faculty that want to change. But I can talk a little bit about how the group of students actually came to us and said, we need some support here, because they said that they were being infantilized. They felt that the university education that they were given was treating them like incapable kids, basically, that just needed to feel good and to be happy and things like that. And these were students interested in unsustainability and racism and colonialism and all of that, right? And they felt that the university was not ready to do something. So we created this secret society groups of both students and faculty, so that we could support each other. And a lot of things have happened. Like, there is a climate emergency task force, but we saw that the students here in Canada, at least, they have a much more direct line with the president of the university and with the top of the university than I have, for example, as faculty, right? So being in the background and supporting them, like listening, but also support, mentoring in terms of what kind of arguments could work. And so at this point, because of the pandemic, because of the violence, we have actually a group called Preparing for the End of the World as We Know It, which is really good. This would never happen before the pandemic, I don't think, but now it's possible. So you have to walk with what's possible, right? In the, because before, if we said this, they would say, you are contributing to mental health problems. Nobody wants to hear it. Now people have to hear it because it's in front of us. It's already the end of the world as we know it. It's not the end of the whole world. It's just the end of the ways we use to operate in the world. And now there's much more interest. So it depends on where your university is at, where the students are at, whether you have a group of faculty, you can start to put the education forward. So there's two things we did then as a faculty. Number one, we had a very strong statement about higher education is about being able to have sober, accountable, and multi-voiced, generative discussions about alternative futures. So that we said that is one of the things that universities have to do. It's not about contributing to economic growth. That's the secondary thing. The second thing is that we should not infantilize the students. The students need to be prepared for the complexity of the world, for the uncertainty, for the wicked problems, for something, for, because they are receiving an inheritance. We have created a world that they, a mess that they will have to sort out in a way. And it's like this intergenerational thing. But that education is about growing up. It's about becoming elders. And we have to sort out how to do that ourselves, because we didn't have any, the whole society infantilized all of us. Not just the students feeling infantilized. We are also infantilized. So we need to get our shit together to start to become elders on the go and say that education is about eldership. It's about you become good elders for everybody, for all relations, human and non-human. And once you start from that, It's not about you being a happy individual, you having social mobility. It is about a collective vision of well-being and healing and justice. So trying to put that forward was difficult, but like in the cracks of the university, it's possible, although like 80% or even 90% of people still think that education is for something else. But I think the crisis now are really helping us have these cracks and work together in very different ways. So with the students too, one of the things we realized is that these students who are saying, please don't infantilize us, they are not afraid of having the difficult conversations. They are not, there's hunger for it. But for many colleagues, like if you raise the issues, the students are gonna fall apart because they don't have the effective, they don't think they have the effective structure to be able to sit with all of this. But the truth is, not that the students will fall apart, we will fall apart as faculty because we don't have the structure to hold all of this complexity either. A lot of my colleagues are just eager to go back to normal because and really suffering right now why we can't go back to normal, why I can't have the way on my terms, the life that I chose for myself. And if we don't, if you are not in the kind of a crisis where you see that the normal that we had was based on violence and was based on unsustainability, and you have the impetus to look for something else, it's very difficult to interrupt that. But the students are doing it. Not all the students, some of the students are organizing and saying, that's it. We're gonna have to sort out this mess. And you are not even preparing us for that because you are treating us like kids and we don't want that. And then we say to ourselves, shit, that's true. And we don't know how to do it either. We better get our shit together so that we can be good elders too. And good elders doesn't mean we will tell them what to do, but we will be able to support what is needed. And part of growing up, I think, is doing what is needed rather than what you want to do. So we've been spoiled, basically, in terms of doing what we want to do all the time. But the planet needs us to show up differently. The planet needs us to grow up. The relationships have been damaged, right? Another discussion that was interesting is with the academic freedom. I don't know if you have this in Germany, but here we have an academic freedom group of students who try to bring in controversial things to the university, which for me is great. I think we should be able to have conversations about anything at the university. The problem is that we are not mature enough to do that. And then it can become violent. So we have had to have a conversation about how do we build the community in ways that we can have these conversations with very controversial speakers without it turning into more violence. That is the question. It's not whether we will have them or not, but how do we have the structure necessary for it to be a sober conversation, a generative conversation where we can disagree without wanting to kill each other. And we don't have that yet. So we have to figure out what's the next step. The next step is building that. It's not necessarily just bringing people to provoke violence, right? To provoke this conflict, to deepen the conflict. And I think this was a generative conversation. But there are also outside forces from the university influencing. So there are political groups now putting a lot of money into educating young people who are at the university, but outside of the university. There's something here in the US called Prager University with all the... Some of them are conservative views, which are fine, but some of them are ultra conservative, far right kind of views. And they make these very short videos that are extremely well made And they really shift. It's the kind of the fake news kind of thing that if you're not prepared really to identify that, you get caught and you get emotionally caught. And what they are trying to do is to weaponize, you know, I don't know if you have that word in German, but you turn it into a weapon. So they weaponize transgression. So young people, they're really into transgression because that's what it is. That's the period of life where you can get adrenaline and dopamine from transgression. But if you have a group of a political movement weaponizing this transgression, this becomes very dangerous. Because like in the 60s, this was already happening, but it was kind of the hippies or the left, and it was kind of moving more towards justice or like anti-nuclear movements, anti-war movements. And that was probably like much better for the collective good. Now, if this same strategy is being used by people who are anti-migration, who are anti-Black or anti-Indigenous people, who are like Bolsonaro or Trump Bolsonaro in Brazil and Trump in the United States, about really weaponizing everything, turning everything into weapons, then it becomes very dangerous. And we can go back to comparing the period here and what is happening here in this sense with the periods between the two world wars, right? Where the tensions really rise and we start to not care if other people get killed, or we start to want to deal with the shit by killing each other. And that is what I'm worried about too, because when we have more, like if we're going to stick with the shit, when shit hits the fan, we may just bring out the guns, as Trump has mentioned already, right? If people bring out the guns, then it's going to be immature culture killing itself, basically. And that's not that is one of the things we would like to figure out, if there's any way for us not to do that, because the crises are coming anyway. It's just how we are going to respond to the crisis that can make any difference. So that's part of what we're trying to do. Marie?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it really. Like, it's really, thank you for elaborate your like response so much, and like giving so many examples. For me, it's really like a lot and inspirational somehow. Yeah, and there are other questions. There's another question. Thanks a lot for this super interesting talk, as I'm interested in approaches towards decolonizing our mind, our imagination as you stated it. I would like to know what you think in what else than concepts people are thinking, because you stated that thinking and concepts, it's not our way. In my understanding of concepts, there's no other way than thinking in concepts, even if your example of the mushroom metaphor is based on a particular perception of the world.
Yeah, so we tend to think that our thinking is our being, and that's a very strong German tradition, actually, because it comes from... like Kant actually was the one that really consolidated it. But of course, there's Hume, Descartes, and all of that before. What the indigenous people were saying is that our relationship with language is a very particular one. And I'm putting myself on the German side now, right? So I'm looking at what I'm being taught. So they say that our relationship with language is like as if language describes reality or constructs reality. Their relationship with language is that language moves reality. Language is also an entity that works with you. It's not something that you create necessarily. It works with you and through you. So when they tell a story, for example, that story is not supposed to be an index of reality. It's a story is just a story that is moving things. It's not a description of things. So one of the stories that I was told, for example, that illustrates this difference. And then what, okay, well, I'll talk a little bit about what difference does it make? The difference it makes is that there is a, in their relationship with reality, language, the stories or knowledge is not the mediator. It's a more direct relationship with reality, but the reality is unknowable. Therefore, you are also unknowable. And you use the stories to move things, but you also keep a very big space in your being for what is unknowable and what, but unknowable, but existing, right? And operating between us. So it's a more metabolic way of operating. So thinking about our body, there's lots going on in our body that we don't know, but that we don't even think about. They think about that. they know that there's a lot going on, but that is not in their mind. So they don't pay too much attention to the mind. They pay attention to the whole thing. And in relation to stories, what I was told was that, like, if they're telling you a story, like there's a story of when you go into a forest, you have to make an offering as you enter the forest. It could be an offering of berries or tobacco or something, because there are little people there, like gnomes or something, right? That can hide from you, but they are not necessarily matter. They can be spirits. It doesn't matter. So if you give this thing in the forest, if you get lost in the forest, they will help you find your way back. That is the story. Now, if you ask them, is this true? Like, there are people or not, and blah, blah, blah. They say, sometimes. So not always. Their relationship with truth is not, it is or it isn't. It depends. Right? It depends on a number of different factors. And it takes a very long time for us to be able to operate in that way, not to see stories as indexes. So when we take people to indigenous communities, for example, they want to write everything down that other people say. But that's, to put it in an encyclopedia, but that's not the way they relate to knowledge. So when we came with lots of questions, and we started asking questions about, for example, their understanding of what sustainable development would be. Not that we like the word sustainable development. Sustainable is just economic growth, but in a different disguise. But so we started asking, and every day the answer would be different. Not because they are confused, but because there is much more going on in terms of how they use language and mobilize knowledge than what is apparent to us. My understanding when I did that was that, just give me an answer and I'll just put it in my research project. But that doesn't work like that, right? That it's a very different, and in that relationship with language, there's much more room for movement. And there, that's why when I went to a community in Australia, in Uluru, when I also came with the same set of questions. This was in 2006, so it's a long time ago. And this group of women wanted to talk. And they said, okay, we'll talk to you. And then I said, okay, here are the questions. They said, no, you have to sit with us for 4 days on the earth in silence and without clothes at the bottom, like having your bottom touching the earth, because we want you to declutter. We can't be about all these concepts. We want the land to speak through your body and through our bodies together. And I was like, gee, I only have 7 days. And how am I gonna sit on the earth without talking for 7 days? This is for 4 days, this is not possible. But I did it anyway. I said, okay, I'm here. If I don't do the questions, what can I do? So I sat there, and the first day, all these concepts were coming and coming, and lists of things to do, and a lot of irritation, like, what am I doing here? What are you doing with me? And then I tried again, and yes, I did have some yoga experience too, and meditation and things like that. And I tried that, and it didn't work, because all my mind was really going and being uncomfortable and irritated. And then in the second day, it came again, and I got tired. I said, enough. And then I said, enough. It could be enough with the whole thing, or just enough with this conceptual shower in my head. And then when I said that, and the shower went away, and I kind of relaxed, and then the women started laughing. But not, they knew something had happened with my body. It was something like pheromones, or it was something neurobiological. They got it and they started laughing. And then I started laughing as well. We laughed for about 2 hours, just laughing. And then they said, you're ready. Then you can come. Then now there is a possibility of connection there where we can not understand each other, because it's not about understanding either, but it's about connecting. And then we could establish the relationship that took the research forward, and then it was easier. But for me, the lesson that I took is how much our concepts that mediate our relationships actually become a barrier for other ways of being in the world that are not based on that. And then from that day on, whenever I went to meetings and people said, okay, we need first to define the word. And I said, these definitions might be useful, but people understand them in different ways anyway. So instead of trying to define the words, each word, and come up with a policy and blah, 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 I'm much more interested in what moves things, what moves us to relate to language in a different way, to relate to the body in a different way, to relate to being in a very different way. And I think the last thing I have to say about this too is my son, who's 27, he was doing a PhD in Toronto. He actually is studying this in linguistics. So how our ways of relating to language in Western societies cannot capture what's happening in indigenous languages. And he did that. He came to that that research because he was working in an indigenous dictionary with people here in my province in BC. And what he saw was that he would go to indigenous elders and he would ask a question that was in the script too. And the indigenous elders would say much more that wouldn't fit that template that he had. And he tried to raise the issue and say, we're creating these dictionaries for them, right? For the indigenous people of indigenous languages, but we are not really documenting what they are saying. And then the people here said, shut up, don't talk about this. We don't talk about this. We kind of know, but they need the dictionaries, right? And then what he saw was that the dictionaries that were created like that, people would learn the language through the dictionaries and they would go and try to correct the elder and say the elder is wrong because it's in the dictionary and the dictionary is produced by the university and the university is more important. So he said, no, we need to figure out what's going on there. Why is it that our translation, which is based on Chomsky's understanding of the universal grammar, why it can't capture the ways that they relate to language. So he's doing research on that with another group of people. And I think that if they manage to communicate it, it's not just me who thinks, but there is in their group, there is a potential to change everything in linguistics, if they manage to prove that mathematically, basically. And that's what they are trying to do. So there's more to come in this issue in the future. I think we're just touching the beginning of something that can be really big in the future, but that probably it's not gonna be my work.
Yeah, and another person is asking if there's a possibility to get the poem, if that's...
Yeah, I can give you access to the poem on the website. I'll just put I'll find it here and I'll put the address there. Just give me a minute. Experience and kindness. Okay. over here. Put it in the chat.
Okay. Thank you. And with the next question, we are coming back to like, how we understand things, because the person is asking, could you explain the difference between postcoloniality and decoloniality, between postcolonial studies and decolonial studies?
Okay, so postcolonial studies started, we can say it started with Edward Said in his book Orientalism, and it's kind of, it started in the field of literature and English studies or in area studies. So it's a very different origin. So the three people who are the big people in postcolonialism are Edward Said, Gayatri Spivak, and Homi Bhabha. And they are all, Gayatri Spivak is Bengali, I think, Homi Bhabha. So Edward Said is Palestinian, Homi Bhabha is also from South India. I don't remember exactly where there he's from. So it started before the decolonial studies group in Latin America. The decolonial body of work is from South America or Latin America, and it started with Quijano, Mignolo, Escobar, and they are more in sociology. So there are differences related to why they started, where they started, and also what they want to do. And both of them also have bickerings. So the decolonial people say that the postcolonial people were just people who wanted to critique modernity, but they were very much invested a lot in modernity, and they wanted to be part of the canon of modernity. Now, the decolonial people want to delink from, they say they want to delink, I'm not sure if it happens, but they say they want to delink from modernity and create a transmodernity or other forms of modernity that are not necessarily necessarily connected to all the things that modernity stands for. They raise different questions. I think for me, both sets of questions are super important, and they both fail they are both limited in terms of addressing the size of the problems that we have. And when I go to the communities, to the indigenous communities, a lot of the critiques that they have are not represented in the literature, or a lot of the practices that they have are not represented in the literature. And as I said before, they don't want it to be represented in the literature because they are not interested in being part of the university. Some of them are, some young people are actually interested in becoming or having degrees and coming back to the community or doing something else. But if you talk to the elders, they say, we're not interested in that. And actually it's very extractive and appropriative to do that kind of work, to just take our perspective there for somebody else's career, right? So at the basis of it, I think for all the decolonial, postcolonial, the indigenous, is understanding why the hierarchies are there between different cultures, why subjugation is there, why people justify occupying territories, like material colonialism, why people justify promoting just one perspective as the better perspective, why people need to feel superior to other people. And for indigenous people, colonialism is not so much to do with the subjugation of people or the occupation of lands. It's more, how do we come to feel ourselves as separated from the earth, basically? How is it that we feel that we are the most intelligent animals? Or not even animals, we are not animals, we are humans. There are the animals over there. Or there's man in nature. They say, this is ridiculous, we are nature. And we are animals like the other animals. And then they have stories, and it's super funny, because they say, okay, there are all the animals. And then when man came, they said, okay, this is the youngest one. We have to be really patient with them, because they're gonna do stupid things. We do, right? So part of the stupid things that we do is that we create these hierarchies between us and other, and the land, us and the other animals, us and each other, and we consume everything, and we poop everywhere, and we're not really understanding the metabolic cycle of things. So in one of the communities, they say there's individualism, which is what capitalism likes. There's collectivism, which is what socialism likes. And then there's metabolism, which is a completely different form of relating to the world where we are not separated. And these are cultures that also use many practices and techniques that are supposed to descale the ego and also change your relationship with pain. So lots of the ceremonies and the rituals and the rites of passage are about creating this relationship with the metabolism. And they really believe this metabolism is bio-intelligent. And these practices, for example, of fasting or of putting your hand in being bitten by lots of ants in the Amazon that are this big and that have a terrible bite, this relationship with pain, this relationship with deprivation of things, give you visions. Or sometimes they ingest also psychoactive substances that give you vision. And they say that they have survived because of these visions that they have. So like in the West, the equivalent would be the psychedelic. Like in the 60s too, the psychedelics gave some of these visions. But for them, it's something that has helped them survive for millennia. And for example, when there was a drought, the visions would tell them what to do, where to find the water, which plants they could eat, which plants they couldn't, which plants were healing for what disease, and things like that. So the reliance on practices of vision are also related to this idea, this lack of investment in understanding or concepts, because they have a very different way of relating to their own unconscious, and they have access to a collective unconscious that is not based on people, it's based on the land itself, it's based on the earth. So that's the best way that I have to explain how it's different, right? Whereas our way of modernity is socialized to relate to the world through concepts, we try to describe everything so that we can engineer everything and have some predictability, some teleology, so where we're going, so that we can plan. And this works up to a point, right? As the house of modernity starts to fall apart, we might need the visions to see where we could go. Right. And I'm not here advocating for you to take psychedelics, because I think that the consumption of psychedelics is terrible, actually, because it can deepen individuality in many cases. Right. That's what we see sometimes. For you to be able to do the visions in the way indigenous people do, you have to have a lot of discipline, a very different relationship with pain, a lot of guidance to guide the unconscious in the way that it moves away from consumption. You can't be consuming things and thinking you're going to get the same thing. So a lot of these practices are about relating differently to pain and to death and to loss and to fear, right? And to changing that sense of worthlessness that modern society also inculcates in us. So modern society, because we're separated from the land, creates this sense that we have to produce value to feel that we deserve to be alive in the economies that are available, right? So you are either minus one in your crap or plus one in your superior to something. And what they are saying is that we need to be zero. We need to go back to this idea. We are part of a metabolism, and this metabolism is sick. And we really... this minus one plus one doesn't work. It's not about how you feel. If you feel less or more than other people, it's this necessity for us to feel this visceral equanimity that leads to responsibility and accountability. That's what they want our being to be. And they say It's not from the head to the body. It's actually from the guts to the heart, and the head follows. It's a very different pedagogical thing. But as I said, what we do in the collective is just a very probably bad translation of what they do there. In that sense. And I'm not saying that there's no problems there. There are lots of problems there. There's every society, every knowledge system is limited and has got problems and all of that. But these practices we have lost. So one of the things we're trying to do is figure out how we bring practices back to our bodies that can have the same effect of vision and healing that they have kept as a survival mechanism for their cultures. But we cannot just go there and grab their practice and bring it here. It doesn't work like that. And it's unethical to do it like that. We have to probably we are going and learning there what it does and coming back and saying, what can we do here that would have the same movement, the same effect in terms of bringing exiled capacities back, so that our bodies can do something different than try to consume or try to describe everything and try to control everything. How do we get out of the narcissistic thing, right? And the fears and insecurities behind that. How do we not kill each other? That would be a nice one to do. Or how do we not destroy the planet at the rate that we... So these are the kinds of things we're interested in, and being inspired by these difficult practices that they are like terrible in a way, because like putting your hand into this ant, they make a glove with these ants, and the pain is incredible. And it's also good for your body. It's the formic acid is actually good for you, but the pain, who would want to put their hand in a thing for pain? We run away from pain in our society. For us to be well, we have to be pain-free. For their society, well-being has nothing to do with not having pain. That's another thing for us to hold. And that's why they're more resilient. That's why there's more stamina to be able to keep going even when things get really difficult, right? So these are the kinds of things we've been thinking about.
Thank you so much for like talking it out again, or to expressing it. And there's another question which is going in the kind of same direction. I don't want to forget it, but maybe we also already, or you already answered it. Is there another main difference between post-colonialism and deep colonial thinking, besides that post-colonialism refers mainly to the 19th and 20th centuries? So.
There is a very good text by Mignolo from the decolonial side that has the critique of post-colonialism. So I'll put the text here because I think that will give you more. Basically, they're saying you are too invested in modernity. You have a critique of modernity that is still invested in modernity. And they say our critique is not invested in modernity. We want to delink. But I would say it's too invested too. So one of the things that I think is important, there are these two different and related bodies of knowledge, but they are also limited, right? And now here in North America, at least, you see people using decolonialism or decoloniality or decolonization for a lot of different things. So, and sometimes it becomes very trivial. Like, I don't like how the chairs are organized in the classroom. I want it to be a circle. Let's decolonize this. And this is becoming senseless, right? Why would you? It becomes anything that I don't like, it's a decolonial project or a decolonization. So it's becoming a little bit meaningless in that sense. But the disciplinary origins that you would see, if you have to make reference to that, it is the modernity coloniality group in Latin America. We use them especially also Boaventura de Souza Santos, I think, is very good at establishing ideas about how different knowledges intersect. And he has lots of very interesting propositions, the work of Mignolo. We use a lot of Maldonado Torres because he talks about being in ways that are very useful if you talk about indigeneity. And we use a lot of Eve Tuck. There's a very good article called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. And in this article, she then critiques a lot of this use of decolonization. And she says, the only decolonization that would be legitimate is returning the land to the indigenous people. That is decolonization, right? Just give the land back. And then where would you go, basically? So it's very contested, and it's being consumed in a very problematic way, I think. And in this consumption, people may say, oh, I'm doing this and then I'm not colonial anymore, or I'm breaking with coloniality. But for us to break with this, it's a much bigger project. It's not, and it will probably require the world, the end of the world as we know it, because the world as we know it is modernity, coloniality, everything that gives us enjoyment, securities, comforts, it's all coming from the same system, right? There's no way if I become vegan or if I go to the work by bike, that's I'm delinking. Also because your desire to be purer or to be superior to other people is also colonial. So it's much deeper than that. And we don't even have the educational capacity to even hold that depth and that breadth of the problem. So when I read these things and I see even sometimes in the Latin American group, like we are doing the work, that's the first sign that they are not, basically. Because if you were really doing the work, you would see how hard it is and how like overwhelming in many ways it is. So if you're self-celebrating and saying, I'm in the good team, no, there's one team and we're all in it. And its vulnerabilities are unevenly distributed and we need to look after that. But it's one planet, it's one metabolism. The metabolism is sick. And this is not in the literature though, right? Even in the Anthropocene literature, the post-humanist literature, the desires behind these literatures are still colonial desires, because it's very difficult to break with the desires. So we have to go for the literature, of course, but with that suspicion and skepticism, because we can't really decolonize through reading. We can't really decolonize through even riding a bike or not eating meat or working with the indigenous. We can't do that. It doesn't work like that. It's much, much deeper than that and difficult. So, but it doesn't mean that it's discouraging. It's actually, if you look at it through a generative perspective, it's quite, it's not hopeful, because I like hope for what then? It's hope beyond hope, right? You have to hope for something you can't imagine, for people who are not you, for people who are gonna be here after you, and not only people, other animals, and for a planet that is going to be here. So it's not about the ego, basically. It's about a commitment that goes beyond the time where you are in this body. And to mobilize that goes, it's not about writing about it just to posture how virtuous you are or how innocent you are or how, it doesn't work like that. But these things can help and have a place. It's just not the big thing. I also have the book. There's a book called Actionable Postcolonial Theory in Education, which I wrote in my PhD, actually. It was my PhD in 2006. And there I think I did a little bit of the this is that, but at that time, so it probably is outdated by now. But the I think the Mignolo text, which is, I think, 2012, which is a decolonial critique of post-colonialism kind of thing, it might be the best place to start. And I'll put it here. I'll just find it. But you can continue. I'm hearing.
Thank you really much. It connects also to the next question because, one other person thanked you for giving the talk and that she relates to your words. And also thanks you for sharing this special poem. And she asked, do you have a recommendation about what we could do ourselves to support this complex change? And I think you already got into that in your last reply, but I don't know if you have some other specific answers to that question.
So the students who we work with, when the pandemic started, they started pressuring us to say, what do we do? What do we do? We were like, we don't know yet. This is unfolding. And why do we have to do something right now? So we kind of tried to escape from the question, but they kept insisting. So we have actually a document that we, at this time, what can we do, basically? So I can send a link to that. Should be a Google Doc. We haven't published it on the website, but it's a Google Doc that just gives you an idea of what to do at an individual level, at the collective level, and with land. Just as a starting point. It's not a political manifesto. It's not anything. It was just like when the pandemic hit and it was before the eruption of violence, actually. What could you do just to stabilize your system so that you can be useful, right? But I think the quick answer to your question is build capacity, prepare. Because this level of complexity, the level of everything is going to become even more. This is what we're living today are the warning shots of something more serious that's coming. So build your capacity to first to have more space for complexity, uncertainty, and all of that and difficulty without being overwhelmed, irritated, or immobilized. That's the first thing. So you have to build the stamina. The second thing is to nurture in yourself the parts of, this is not a value, this is a practice of generosity, compassion, patience, sobriety. Because sobriety comes from the analysis that, and it's from somebody in France, what's his name? Forgot. But he's coming from Alcoholics Anonymous and saying, we are behaving like heroin addicts in terms of consumption, right? So we just want the next hit. And this works on Facebook or social media. We want just the next hit, right? So in order to stop an addiction, it is necessary to go first to reach rock bottom and then to go on withdrawal, but with support. It's not, you can't just go cold. So go cold turkey. So what's necessary then is in order to mobilize these capacities that we have inside ourselves that have been exiled by modernity, you will need practices of the body, cultural somatics, basically, to be able to come out of that. So I'll just share then the Google Doc and then share a few resources on cultural somatics, maybe. So the work of Resma Menakin, there's a book called My Grandmother's Hands, which is about healing of racial trauma on all populations, might be one. His work aligns in some ways with the work we do, but there are also differences. And then I'm just gonna find the Word document. The Word document is called, I think, Hospice Modernity. Hospice. Yeah. Share. So there are some students who made comments there, but I will put you guys as commenters too. Copy link, done. So this is the link to the Google Doc that we created for the students.
Thank you so much for sharing all these resources and also, yeah, works in progress somehow. Thanks.
Yeah. It is definitely work in progress. We haven't, now with the eruption of violence, we would have to go back there, but we've been so busy with the other things that we haven't had the time. I can also share the radical tenderness document, which is also another way. This is the song that we recorded yesterday, but I don't have the song recorded to share yet because it needs to go into production. But I will, yeah, this one. I will share this one, the radical tenderness one. The radical tenderness is an invitation for people to also take these ideas of, it's not about getting rid of the ego, but it is about not making it central to what we're doing and allowing other things, allowing your being to be more spacious in that sense. So I'll just change with the link. Restricted, only people added can open this thing. So this one I cannot. I cannot really share, but I can share the old one. There is an old version of it. Okay, let me just go there. Experiments. There's a new version and old version, radical tenderness. I think that was this one. Okay, so this one has changed and become a song. But this is the old version of it. It's called radical tenderness. So this idea of a practice of radical tenderness as a political practice of healing. Mm-hmm. But it has changed a lot since the last time.
I don't know how much time you still have to answer our questions. There are two more. I don't know if you would be in for doing those last two and then maybe making it round and finding an end to the talk. What do you think? I can't hear you right now.
Ah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, back again.
Okay, sorry. So if you read the question, I'll try to respond in 4 minutes.
Okay. So there's one question which is maybe simple, maybe not. As I'm coming from a cognitive linguistics background, could you provide me with information about the project you mentioned in the end? That would be fantastic.
There's no web link to that, but what I can do is offer you a paper, two papers that started the group. And then you will know the people who are involved. Is that okay? So I'll send you, who should I send it to? Because I don't know, the papers, one of them is published, but the other one is not.
It's Tanya, but maybe you can also send it to me and maybe the person will get back to me and then I will just send it further.
Yes, or Tanya can also put the email. If you put the email in the chat, I can send it to you after the talk.
That's much better, even. And yeah, another question from Jan. And you, I think, also already talked about that. Are there already examples of focused concepts or methods about how to proclaim this knowledge to young people? I mean, we came a long way now. I don't know really what this knowledge is referring to, but I think it's referring to the knowledge of the metabolism and the but I don't know. I that would be my suggestion.
how to do this with young people? I'll have to, there are many different ways, but it depends on the entry point that you have. So if it's with schools, in the family, now that schools have had to restructure, where are the entry points, right? For schools, forest schools and eco schools have started this work. I think that the metabolism is not there yet, but they have also entry points into this issue. When I work with Indigenous people, they say that the problem with the ecological movement is that people see the earth as an extension of ourselves. So there's a lot of what we call anthropomorphy. And they say it's the other way around. We are an extension of the earth, and that's why we're not as intelligent as we think we are. The earth metabolism is more intelligent than we are. So one of the things that we have to watch for now is with the pandemic, with the schools changing, and with everything becoming more saturated with the crisis, what are the opportunities and the entry points to be able to do this work in the cracks of the system, right? So if you have access to youth groups or to schools, it's getting them out of this idea that we can't change the world through the same systems that created the problems. It's getting them to imagine the unimaginable, right? In imagining the unimaginable, it's about not about imagining something. It is understanding that there's more to be imagined that we can't imagine right now, but we might be able to when the crisis hits. In Brazil, we have this this metaphor of it's a saying that it's only when the water reaches your in a flood situation, when the waters are rising, it's only when the waters reach your bum or your waist that you can actually swim. Otherwise, you can only walk, right? So I think we're still walking with the schools. There's not much we can do in terms of swimming yet because the crisis is not big yet or large enough to be for us to be able to do it. So what I would say is prepare. Prepare by testing things where you can and really not being caught in, oh, I'm already doing it. That's not useful. Just keep going, know that the problem is enormous, but that collectively, I think we will remember we can swim when the water comes. So just get ready for that, be prepared, and tell young people that our bodies were made for this and that we're gonna be okay. Even if we're going to go extinct, we're going to die a good death, not shooting each other. But you have to be modeling for them, I think, this space of knowing all of this and still living a well, like there's a difference between a good life and well living and well dying. So this is the kind of thing we need to model for people, that we can become mature and sober in this and develop more capacity with our other relatives, the animals, the trees, the earth, so that we can withstand the amount of stuff that is going to happen in the storm, right? So be prepared for the storm and try to prepare them as well as you can as the storm hits. That's, I think, my last message.
So, yeah, thank you for all the messages you sent to us. And yeah. It's morning in your place, so have a good day. And thank you really much. Thank you also to all the people who came in to the talk. And yeah.
just with Tanya. Okay, found your address. Yes. Thank you, everybody. I really need to run. It was lovely to see you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Vanessa. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Ja, Marie, es sind noch ein paar Menschen hier in der Leitung, aber ja, vielen Dank nochmal.
Ja, danke dir.
Für deine Arbeit, für deine Moderation. Wir schreiben mal diese ganzen